You're listening to The Weekly, a production of WOBC 91.5 FM. I'm your host, Johan Cavett, and I'm joined by my co-host,
Johan, don't you have to be closer to the microphone?
No, he's fine. He's good.
Okay.
That's all right. We got a tomorrow tech. So I'm joined by Daniel Marcus and Roman Brzkowski. We're also extremely honored to be talking with Robert Kolich, who is returning to campus to celebrate his 50th reunion and to accept an honorary Doctor of Fine Arts degree. Kolich earned a bachelor's degree in history at Oberlin College in 1969.
That was another thing. Like, when I get the call, I say, like, you know I went here, right? I said, what do you mean? I said, like, I already got a real degree.
It is a little strange.
Yeah. So I said to Jad, my partner in the reader, they just gave me an honorary degree. He says, did you tell them that you went there?
Hey, listen, maybe the registrar's messed up something. Right. The original one's invalid.
You can't get a doctor or anything here because this is not a university, so they just have to give you the same thing over again?
Well, they give double degrees, so now you're just being given the... I don't know.
Are you getting a double degree?
Yeah, I'm getting two. I'm getting two. It's very fun.
So you can't get an honorary because they have to stutter right. their way through it.
Right. Well, the nice thing is when you get the 2 degrees, like you open the little diploma folder thing and there's just two of them, one on each side.
Oh,
and
wow.
You just hold it open and it's got the both, which is very fancy.
It's like a wallet. Two sides.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, you keep going.
Anyways. We are so pleased to have you with us.
I'm ruining this introduction, aren't I?
No, this is great.
Okay.
So in fall 2016 was, to my knowledge, the last time you were on campus. You gave a talk called Oberlin Itches, So I Scratch, a Private 50-Year Fight with My College, to the annual Friends of the Library dinner. I think a couple of us were there. And just personally, I was in a class at that time sort of talking about... the Odyssey and identity and sort of being a first year on campus. So that really sparked something for me, sort of thinking about, like, what is Oberlin identity? How do I relate to this institution that I've chosen and how do I fit in here and things like that? So I guess I'm wondering, I think you put a lot of sort of your thoughts and your experiences very eloquently in that talk. Are there things that have changed coming back for 50 years or?
I don't know if The Gibsons thing somehow got to New York, and people began calling. So, like, what's the deal with that? Like,
it also got to trial. So there's that.
Right, and then it got to the head of my class, Wayne. He called up, who is prosecuting this lawsuit? Like it seems weird to me. Like, you've hired a Republican law firm, the Taft Law Firm in Cleveland. They generally don't do Oberlin-y kind of things. You're spending a holy fortune on them. They, meanwhile, are deposing, which is expensive, every single person they can think of.
Mm-hmm.
And shouldn't you just settle this? Because it's sort of murky, the facts, frankly, says Wayne. And he said, so, like, why don't you just, like, the kid who got in the fight, you know, admits that he did what he did, but then now there's all this other layer of things, and
right.
the college seems to be somewhat suspiciously involved, and not, why don't you just get out? And why would you want to aggravate an entire town's merchant group if you're going to planning to continue to make relations with the town? So I don't know whether any of the things that we in New York were thinking are being thought about here. But that was a weird part. I thought, what's going on? And then the other thing was, of course, the financial thing, which President Ambar came to talk about. And so I went to that. But I guess my always question is, when you go to a place like this, it's full of passion. It really is.
Yeah.
And much more so than other places you could have gone to. And if you have friends at these other places, they will tell you without telling you that their experience is just a little less coerced or a little less wonderful and a little less crazy and a little less challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And I have never, ever thought that those experiences, the collisions I had with friends who were much more in love with Viet Cong than I could ever possibly be, or utterly convinced about certain oughts and certain rights. I was always a much more of a, I don't know, let me think about this, I'd like to read a book. And so I think if I hadn't gone here, I might, I don't know this, but I might not have been as comfortable with my perpendicularity. A word which I later thought of after the talk. I thought, what Oberlin actually gets you to do, although it doesn't do it very well here because everybody seems to be of semi-like mind, But they know that they're not of the mind of the neighbors, even in Lorain or in Grafton.
Yeah.
So what you do is you learn to be on fire, and you're burning, and other people aren't burning with you. And you have to learn how to live like that. And that's what this place is really practiced for. It's practiced for never feeling particularly comfortable or exactly like you own the situation, either too whatever you're supposed to be, or too much whatever you're supposed to be. And that is a weird continuum, and I have no idea why a misfit situation like that would prepare you for the world. It shouldn't. You should come out an intolerant asshole, probably. But for some reason, I don't. I'm not. And I owe it. I think the war I kept having with this place has made me, has kept me at war gently, but always at an angle to what I walk into. Always.
Yeah, I think that actually, jives really well with one of our last talks, which was with a professor who's leaving here, about, like, what is Oberlin as an institution, and like, what does that mean? Because a lot of us believe that like access to higher education is a fundamental right that people should have in order to help like reach some sort of equality in society. And by definition, as a elite institution, Oberlin, you know, hampers that to some degree. But like, we're benefiting from that. So like, the conflict between us is, like, how do we envision Oberlin as a positive force in the world while also recognizing that, like, maybe a positive change in the world doesn't include Oberlin?
I would say I think it might not be necessarily the ideal model for how to, you know, engage with an institution, or necessarily, like, the most comfortable model, but I think it's pretty valuable to have that sort of push and pull, even after you leave. And I think it's like very true. I mean, I'm not an alumni yet, but like hearing from other alumni and hearing people who are still like very involved with what happens at Oberlin and care, you know, a lot about what goes on, which I think is like sometimes can be like annoying and sort of frustrating. But I think generally it's pretty nice to have that sort of, like what you were saying, like engagement or even just like a little bit of a push.
Yeah, there is always a feeling of being a little bit on fire. It's very eloquently described.
Yeah, I think
the town is always a little bit on fire.
Well, I think the interesting thing is, like, even like you can come from two different political positions or life positions or whatever, and you can both feel that, like, that you're just like a push and pull. Because I don't think
even before Gibson's, even before any of that, like, there was always something that was a little bit on fire.
Always something.
And I think that's. I don't know if that's like good. I don't think it's bad. I think it's like an interesting thing that we're like, there's no one who fits like just perfectly at
all. A lot of people think it's bad.
That's their opinion. But like, what I mean is that, like,
well, it feels bad sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, but like the same way that getting shots feels bad. Like, it can really suck. But it's probably better that you get the shots now than to wait after you get
started. So you don't, none of you think that this experience has narrowed you or made you less able to hear what people who don't agree with you think?
No, I don't think so. Because it's funny because, you know, there's the internet and people are always getting involved in arguments on the internet, and you're either involved in them or you're a witness to them.
Right.
Or if you're really lucky, you're not involved at all and you like don't have the internet and, you know, congratulations. But I think one of the things that older alumni who I have engaged with both in person and online are always asking for is, you know, just, you guys are too far to the left. You have all these things, you know, you get upset about food in your dining halls and so on and so forth, blah, 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 and you get upset about Gibson's. And I think the thing that the alumni seem to want, which is for me to not entertain any sort of more radical theories of justice or whatever, or the way that they want me to behave is the way that I behaved in high school, you know? Like, I already did there. I came from an upper middle class liberal family. My dad was a lawyer. I got those you know, neoliberal values down just fine. Like, I already did that. And so it seems to be asking for something that a lot of us, I think, have already done. It's like we already all You know,
was it easy for you to strip off your more neoliberal orthodox behaviors and become whatever you now are?
No, it took a lot of time.
Yeah, but I also don't think like it's a conscious like stripping away of yourself. I think it's like anything that happens in college is part of growth. You know, like I definitely like have become more left at college.
Yeah.
When was that hardest for you? When did you actually stumble?
So I think that a lot of it has to do with like, so when you have an opinion that you hold very dear to yourself and that you fits within a larger framework. So for example, if you believe in social justice and you hold an opinion that kind of fits kind of awkwardly within that framework,
mm-hmm.
being confronted with that is really hard. Or being confronted with, like, what's a good example?
Yeah, what were you confronted with that you found?
I remember from freshman year, one that I was confronted with, which I don't know if I ever figured it out. Like, I still don't know if I know what I think about it, was there was, I don't know if it was part of Joy Correga, but there was a petition that went around from the Black Student Union that was about like extending finals or like giving people more time to complete finals or giving them.
That was way before.
It was before.
That was with Trayvon Martin.
Yeah.
I wasn't here for that. Yeah.
Or Mike Brown or maybe both.
I think it was Trayvon because it was in Cleveland.
Was it because people went to protest?
Yeah. And they were asking for more time with the finals.
Yeah. So at the time when I was a first year, I thought that was the most outrageous thing that I had ever heard. And I was so angry, and I wrote an angry email to Student Senate, because I think Student Senate came out in support of it, and I thought that was crazy and didn't represent my views, and so on and so on and so forth. And that was a very like high school kind of response, and it was during my freshman year, so it made it makes sense that because.
Well, high school is your word for it now. I don't know what will happen to you in the future.
Right, that's true. But I guess the point is that I don't really feel like I lost that set of beliefs or set of instincts or conclusions about the world. They just became intermingled with other ones.
Well, did somebody come up to you and say in a quieter voice, "Oh, look, I wanted to something about Michael Brown or Trevor Martin. I wanted to do that, and then, but I have a chemistry exam, and I don't know, what help. Like, I just all I'm asking for is just can I have my cake?
It doesn't really happen. Like an individual person comes up to
you. Oh, it's not.
No. It's really like, I think like a more organic process where it kind of just after you've been seeped in it for a while, and like you just are around different people, and like it just kind of like. You start to look, okay, so I think a really good example is like a large part of like my shift. I was already liberal, but like a large part of my shift to like someone who's like more to the left was after the election in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And also like the Gibson protests, mm-hmm. just because like for me it was really theoretical. Like I didn't think that Trump was going to win. I didn't really see this as like I thought it was kind of stupid and actually had a viewing party. And it was like, going on.
They had one at the SCO, too, and it was like...
You mean everybody came to just enjoy the Hillary election?
Yeah, and there's a front page photo on the issue of the Oberlin Review from the next Friday with just people with, like, their heads in their hands.
Are you in that?
No.
But what I mean is that, like, it would have been really, really easy for me to just be like, okay, the election's over, like, that was a theoretical, and now, like, I just move on with my life. If I had just been surrounded by people who were like me, who thought like me. But the problem is when you're not surrounded by people who think like you, when you're surrounded by people who voted for Trump or people who didn't vote for Trump or people who feel like they shouldn't have voted in the election at all, you have to confront those ideas, and they're ideas that are constantly being talked about, regardless if it's just one-on-one.
Wouldn't that be going on in any college, though?
Wouldn't that be going on
in McAllister and in Lorraine Community College?
I think any one of our peer institutions... I don't think any school.
I think school in general is like a radical institution just because it brings people together from many different backgrounds. And because it's about education. And I think education itself leads to like people changing their opinions.
But neither of the two of you actually can demarcate it. It just sort of happened like you were a sponge and you began to sponge in this new sensibility.
The problem is like I don't think it's like you suck it up like it's foreign. I think that the difference is...
You adopt it.
I don't know if it, but I feel like adopt is the wrong terminology, because I think that adopt like makes it seem like it is artificial, that you're doing it for a different purpose. When in reality, what I'm saying is like I had opinions. Those opinions were challenged by facts. And then like I had to move on from that and be like, okay, how do I reassemble myself, or how do I reassemble like my worldview? And I think that happens to a lot of people.
But do people around you, have they assembled themselves differently than you? Like if you were to look at your 6 closest friends, have they all traveled the same more or less trip that you have, or have they traveled differently?
I would say differently.
Yeah, different.
I'm going to even jump in and say, like, I think this is like, I think it is true though, but I feel more conservative after coming to Oberlin, just sort of by process of comparison, and I think process of being more nuanced in how I think about my own political processes, because like I like similarly grew up in like a very like urban Minneapolis like public school, like yeah. Most people, like the high school newspaper that I came from is like still like the most liberal thing I read. It's very funny. but so I think like that I sort of came up and was very much like unassuming of what my political beliefs were, and that coming to Oberlin, seeing that contrasted, even if it was like different, a spectrum mostly on the left, seeing that allowed me to put myself within that spectrum like differently than how I had assumed I was. Because I think I just always like assumed I was like fairly political, and like that was something that not everyone shared. And coming to Oberlin, that was something that a lot of people shared, and so I was able to differentiate myself a little bit more. And I think it is more difficult. Like, right, like I don't necessarily have the tools always to engage with people on the other end of the spectrum. Like, even I was talking to someone who went to Washington University in St. Louis, and it was just, they were talking about like, oh, I'm in a frat. And I was saying like, I eat in a co-op in Oscar. And they were sort of like trying to say like, oh, frats and co-ops are the same thing. Which is not necessarily like a political difference.
It's also like not necessarily untrue.
Yeah. But I think there's like basis, like there's like, you know,
yeah,
different like...
I like frats. I like co-ops. I don't like frats.
Yeah. But I think there's like different ideals, right? That like co-ops are like more interested in like local eating and like environmental initiatives and like not having rules, you know.
But why do you say you think you're more conservative?
So I think maybe in perspective, like I always assumed I was liberal and didn't necessarily question that or elements of that. And that sometimes...
Well, that was starting from day one, right? But when you got here,
yeah,
you were already talking.
I think even because I took a year off before that too. Mm-hmm. And so that process happened when I was outside of my... Mm-hmm. Whatever my original bubble was.
Yeah. And I think it's just like a normal part of like growing up. Like I grew up in a pretty conservative area actually in northern New Jersey. My congressman was the guy who founded the Freedom Caucus. Like,
oh, great.
He was in power for 14 years. he eventually got ousted because he said that he would not give the RNC any money for funding gay candidates. So like pretty far to the right. And like I grew up with around those types of people. And like actually in high school, I feel like I was more conservative than I am now, obviously. But like I had like conservative teachers. And I think in high school, the power dynamic is greater than between teachers and students than it is in college. And actually, I think that I adopted more of the politics of my high school professor than from any professor I've had at Oberlin.
Have you gotten more clues and more persuasion from friends here than you have in high school?
Oof. I think it's a hard question.
I don't know that, I mean, at least for me, the high school that I went to, I consider to be a mini Oberlin. It was like a liberal utopia in the District of Columbia.
Was it private or public?
Private. And okay. We all called our teachers by their first names.
Oh,
and,
okay.
You know, sat around and sang Kumbaya. And so I like at least where I went.
So you like you were you're like a red baby in the old communist days. You'd already been you yeah. already
maybe
yeah.
But also you know the level of politicking that goes on here was far and above anything that we did in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
is it too much sometimes for you?
Oh yeah, but it's good. It's like going to the gym. You know, it's like you go to the gym and you lift weights and your muscles are like, please, no more of this. Yeah. And then you do more and then you wake up the next morning and you're a little bit more muscular. It's kind of nice.
I mean, like I went to public school and very different experience. I had a teacher yell at me continuously for like an entire class period because he thought I said that climate change was real.
But it was real.
It is real.
Right.
my point is, like, I think like when you're in high school, the like backgrounds of everyone that you're with are pretty much the same, because it's very localized. Yeah. And then at college, I think what's really helped shift my opinion, and maybe this is just a really personal thing, is just I've been able to ask questions to other people from like very, very different backgrounds, like very different experiences or parts of the world.
But when you came here, did you go through, I'm going to just describe a paradigm and see if it fits.
Yeah.
You come, it's all a little strange and a little bit different, or in your case, very familiar, but still a little bit different. So you kind of make some friends, like two or three or five or six that are convenient friends, plus real friends. And then a year goes by and they're still your core group. And then another year goes by and they're still your core group. And then in the last year, this is before you, in the last year, you decide to break out and you start talking to people and hang out with people that you had not even thought to do that 2 years earlier here. So it's get a gang, hold on to the gang, stick with the gang, explode in the fourth year.
I don't see that.
I mean, at points.
Is that?
But it was sort of like get a gang, lose them, get some of them back with new people, then lose all of them.
What did you do?
Freshman year was
for 5 years.
Was a crazy time. No, it was mostly that we all lived in first year housing and then we all didn't live in first year housing anymore and then it was over.
I see.
But it's strange because it's come full circle. I'm friends with a lot of the people who I was friends with my first year and then I wasn't friends with and now we're friends again.
Huh.
And
well, that's pretty much the opposite of what I just said.
And then I picked some up along the way and shuffled some around. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so it's pretty in scrambled eggs pretty much.
Yeah.
That's what I would say too. Like, I feel like there are people that I was close with freshman year who I just don't talk to anymore.
Yeah.
There are people that I met freshman year that I was like acquaintances and that now I feel like are like very close friends of mine.
Yeah.
They're people who I met when I was a sophomore and they were freshmen, or they were seniors and I was a sophomore and we like became friends. And I think
is there a lot of that? Like, do you know people who aren't in your class?
Yeah.
As well as people who are in your class?
Absolutely.
As well?
There's a decent degree.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. I would say I have some of my closest friends who are not in my class.
Wow. Johan. What about you?
Speaking with
But Johan is like took a year off, so he's like chronologically.
That's true.
Chronologically, Johan's older than me. So it still tracks.
Right.
Do you think that paradigm existed when you were a student?
I don't know. I was just throwing it. Okay. It was Nancy Dye was the president here for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Told me she showed me once a letter she got from the president of Amherst College. And it says, she said, like a lot of people come and they want to consolidate their identity. So they go to Kosher House or Afro House or Gay House or what house, that house. And then they do that intensely for a couple of years as mm-hmm. if sort of trying to emphasize a slight inheritance they want to deepen or they want to know more about it. Then they get stuck in the third year because they know everything and then nothing happens and then something happens. And the college presidents said to each other, in the 50s and 60s, you'd leave your house and you'd come to this place and you'd go crazy. You would meet people that you have never seen before and you were out from under your parents and it was kind of like, you know, whatever can happen, happen. And then it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And they were complaining that the students who were coming to them in the 90s and the aughts were doing all of that on delay. That was there. I couldn't decide whether I had... the thing that actually most intrigues me was my roommate for the first 2 years here died a few days ago.
Oh, no.
So of sorry. Esophageal cancer. Yeah. His wife called me about a week and a half ago and said, well, he's going into hospice. So I wrote him a note. And so when you write a note, you kind of, particularly a note like that, you want to, and I lived with him for 2 years. And it was strange to me. I didn't have as much to, I was a little bit shocked by how little I had to say. Whereas other people whom I met later, I know much better and well kept up with all the years in between, know all about their children and so on. So I find this, I find the business of becoming a friend is actually kind of mysterious and hugely important.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to a degree that I don't think really people completely understand. Like I, at this point, mostly because at Radio Lab, everybody's so much younger than me. Like, so I actually have friends who are half century. Like, they're not just people that work with me, but they're like friends.
Yeah.
That feels to me crazily enriching.
Yeah.
It's like being able to walk in this, walk through different meadows. It's as if you had some house where you could have a meadow, a desert, a mountain range, and a stream all in the same in the backyard.
My middle school biome project.
I was actually talking about this with a friend because, so this year, the freshman class are the first year who do not remember 9/11.
Oh.
And like I really dislike generations. I think that they're really inaccurate and kind of stupid. Mm-hmm. But I do. I will say
it also depends on what your sibling. If you're the baby child of, of 13 brothers and sisters, then you're in a different decade.
I think so. I think that there's a visible difference in how people who were old enough to kind of remember 9/11 versus people who were born right before or right after, and how they act and how they understand the world.
Oh, how?
So. Like, for example, I very, very vividly remember Obama's first election and what that meant for my parents, but also what it meant for just people in general. And, like, I can remember the vitriolic happiness that people felt and the optimism that people felt. A lot of people that I who are younger than me, who are, like, and who are freshmen this year and who I've become friends with, they've never seen that.
And so it's been a grimmer world.
I would strangely say so. Because think about it. Like, so they were, if they were born in 2001, that means that they were 7 when Obama got elected. Yeah. But it also means that their 7 to 11 was basically just the Great Recession for them, and they just remember everyone talking about how terrible the economy was, how there was no work, how everything was bad.
Yeah.
Okay, Obama gets reelected, fine, but he's already president, so it's not like as big of a milestone. And then you have this very divisive election that comes right as they're entering adulthood.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, so in our 50th thing, like a few minutes ago, the guy from the previous class said, okay, just think about this. You're the class of 1969. When the class of 2019 has its 50th reunion, it will be 2069. And boy, will you be dead.
hey, you don't know that.
Yes, somebody will object to that.
Modern science.
Yeah. But then I was thinking, like, so then when I came here, like Millard Fillmore was like that. I'm like a Millard Fillmore person for you guys.
Someone has to be.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, it's a very strange, but anyway, I'm more curious about, so you think that there's something textually, like, you can touch it different about the 2001 babies.
Well, and there's the technological
difference, too. And I think also just, like, how we approach different current events. Because, like, I remember when the Iraq War started. I was 6. Like, and I remember...
I remember when the Korean War ended.
See? See, like, so for me, the guy you beat... the Korean War for me is just, like, completely theoretical, like, very, like, I don't, like... like. And you're just like, I can't picture it at all.
Yeah.
I think it's the same thing kind of for people who were born around 2001 who weren't as old, because for them, it's just like the United States has always been at war in Iraq, and it's always just been a backdrop of their daily lives. And so, I don't know, it really just kind of feels like...
What about the technological thing you just mentioned? Are the 13-year-olds just like leaving you behind and you don't even know what they're doing?
Well, for me, actually, I think that the technology thing is important for both our current generation and the one below us in different ways. Because when we were talking about the sort of like politics of campus and things and why a lot of the students today are so liberal. I think part of it is an information processing thing.
Why?
Because we are, no offense, much vastly more connected than people that are older than us are.
To your machines.
To our machines, but also to...
Different communities are, like, farther away from each other.
Like for example, when if you started here in 1969 as an undergraduate...
65.
Oh, 65. Any time...
The Civil War was still being
In 1965, as an undergraduate, and let's say you took a philosophy class.
Yeah.
What would you read in that class?
White men only.
Right. Well, and we still read that. But we also read philosophers on Reddit and Twitter and people from China and people who live in repressed regimes who are writing under pseudonyms on Tumblr. And there is, I mean, if you think about, if I bet I would be willing to bet that if somebody calculated from the year zero to the year 2000, the volume of information that was produced in books, I would be willing to bet that we've come close in the last 20 years to that same amount of information.
Now, there is some statistic like that. Yeah. It's crazy. But like, I think it's far greater.
But wait a second. Does that make you feel that you have got wisdom to boot or just a lot of information?
I feel like we're more used to processing large amounts of information.
And that there's more exposure.
Yeah.
It changes the speed at which things are going.
Like,
well, that's for sure.
Literally, I was in the car on the way here. My brother was telling my dad a story about a mathematician from Romania who had figured out a way to cheat the Virginia lottery system, basically by buying a bunch of tickets and like so the odds were in his favor. And my dad just goes, "That's a fake story." And my brother's reading it on the Washington Post. So then my brother goes to Wikipedia, starts looking at the sources, and it's like continuing explaining the story, and my dad's like, no, it's just a fake story. It wouldn't make any sense. And I think that it's just, like, I don't think that my dad is bad at telling what's a fake story, what's not a fake story. I think it's just, like, a difference in, like, understanding how information appears on the internet, or, like, what's reliable, what's not reliable.
And the ability of any person, myself included, to dismiss an ideology when it comes from one person... Versus when it comes from one person and you question, wait a minute, maybe there's something to that. And then you go on the internet and you find that there's hundreds of people all talking about the same thing, for better and for worse. Like they're.
But the technological difference you're describing here is the difference between you and your parents, not between you and your 13-year-old cousins.
Yeah, no, yeah.
But then for the 13-year-old cousins, I mean, as much as we're glued to our devices, they are. Inside of them.
And they get it earlier.
Yeah.
Even my sister, who's 6 years older than me, was saying, like, when she went to college for the first time, she didn't have necessarily, like, the same exposure to a lot of things just because, like, Facebook was sort of, like, starting, or, like, people were getting onto Facebook when she, like, first came into college.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, I think that's really broadened it. Like, having social media and having access to all of that has broadened the amount of exposure to sort of wider themes or philosophies or like political matters.
Just to make it difficult for you, like, what are your parents better at than you on information processing?
Doing taxes.
Reading.
Yeah. And just like paying attention to.
I read constantly.
What do you mean? Like, what do you do on the internet? You read all that stuff, right? Or are you listening to streaming stuff?
You skim.
Good at hopping around.
You skim.
Personally, whenever I write something and I edit it, uh-huh. I edit it on paper because I can't read it off the screen. The screen does not, it's everywhere. It's so, there's so much happening, colors, and like I can't focus my eyes on that. And I don't know, I feel like a lot of people my age would probably agree with me.
What about you? What do you feel your parents are better at than you?
Information? Better at than you?
My children? I mean, I've changed. I didn't used to read as richly as I do now. I don't know what happened. I can now read more. I could read one book a month once upon a time. Now I can read 3 books a week. I don't know what happened. Something happened. And here's an example. I met a guy who does finger puppetry with, his name is Barnaby Dixon. He lives in England. I just ran into him.
And is it Oberlin Grand?
He's from the Midlands. I think he's from Barnaby on Twine or something like that. So he has an extraordinary ability for biomechanics. He can make, from his wrist down, he can be a dog or a cat or a dinosaur or a dancing robot or what have you.
Yeah.
And it's when his bird's neck extends and the tail rises slightly, there is something just weirdly prescient about his biological sense. So in my business, I make it a job to find this guy. I invite him to a meeting in Alabama. He doesn't even know where Alabama is. We go there, and we work out a puppetry thing. And he's very funny, and he sings, and he dances. And then I said to him, like, now, can we figure out something smart to do with this skill you have? So, like, what? Now, I figured, well, his puppets can go up in the air and hang, because he can do that. So let's just think about gravity for a moment. And then I just wrote gravity into the web, into the browser, and for some reason the moon came up and astronauts running along the moon, and then there was this picture of an astronaut who fell flat on his face digging something in Apollo 19 or 13 or something, falls down onto the ground, and now he's lying flat on the lunar surface with a 200-pound pack on him, and I just don't know how he's going to get up. He does what in gymnastics is called a planche. He takes his two hands, puts them down on the ground in push-up style, and then throws himself using his arms, because it's 1/6 gravity. He throws himself up and manages to go, oh, and then lands on his feet in one. And I think, how is that possible? Then I call up a friend of mine who's a physicist, and I said, why do so many astronauts fall down? I just watched a reel of astronauts falling down. He said, well, it's inertia. I said, I forgot exactly what inertia is involved in. And I slowly worked my way from the thing I saw to the thing I want to know more about to a conversation. And then I hit books big time on the back end. Mm. So that's just the reporting process. Mm. I think, weirdly enough, I think the visual prompt for me lately is really important, and that's different. So I think what happens is your learning styles change depending on what you're doing with them. I mean, if you're writing college papers, then you have to just, you know, you have to get authority for what you say. If you're doing sort of science entertainment explanatory things, then you're looking for a set of, and your methods seem to gather around what it is you're trying to do. By the same token, I will listen to Moby Dick this summer in a car. Mm. That's the plan.
Well, it's a lot of time in the car.
Because I have to drive 100 miles back and forth to go to a place. So what does that mean? This is all trying to answer your question. What am I better at than you guys? Oh, God, I don't know. It's really boring. I think I'm just older, so I've just read more stuff.
But there's a different way to process that information. I think, like you were talking about, like being able to synthesize or sort of bounce ideas off things that isn't necessarily just going and saying, like, oh, I heard this story, and then Wikipedia referencing. Yeah.
And there's a pacing to that.
Yeah. I think
there is. On the other hand, I can't, you know, I will sometimes see my son or someone your age do what I want to do so much faster than I do it. And also any format change. I mean, this is a whole other thing. Like, when I bought a pencil when I was young, it stayed a pencil. It was a lead object, which you would use with your hands, and it would make a mark on a piece of paper. Today, if you buy pretty much anything, you have a license to use that thing, but the inventor of the thing can change the color of the pencil or the manner of the automobile you think you own. And this is totally uninteresting to the Radiolab people. They have no sense that anything belongs to them anymore. Everything is more or less rented from the man.
What's it called? It's called right to repair.
Yeah, right to repair is part of that. Yeah. Right to own, even.
Yeah, so that's now what? That's now you have to challenge that. Like, well, if you own a Buick in 1926, you fixed it yourself. Now nobody, not even your repairman, knows how to fix it. You just put in the computer chip that apparently broke, whatever that means. Because maybe some, you know, gamma ray. We just did a piece about gamma rays.
Love gamma rays.
Was that my final?
Really?
Yeah, I had to take an astronomy class to graduate.
I see. Well, yeah. So we had a gamma ray that in our show, this couple is driving home, and suddenly the car it's a Toyota, and it just goes, he can't brake it. He gets up and he stands on the brake. He's like riding the brake like a bucking bronco. And his wife is going, what is going on? He said, I can't make the brake break. He ends up, he's doing 75 and weaving through traffic standing up. And when it comes time later to figure out what happened to his brake, Toyota, unlike Ford or Chrysler, puts one chip in to control the brake instead of a redundant. In a Buick or a Chevy, when you push the brake, three chips have to say, the guy wants to brake now. Check. Yeah, guy wants to brake now. Check. Guy wants to brake now. Okay, we brake. That happens at the speed of light, but nevertheless.
Right.
But in this case, it was only one, and it broke because a gamma ray.
No.
Because these chips are now getting so sensitive that they are liable to the influx of electricity from an unknown, or in this case,
gamma ray.
Yes. The radio lab goes and tries to make its case very carefully, so you have one thing after another gets in trouble, all from gamma rays, gamma rays, gamma rays, gamma rays. But that said, do you pity your parents for their slow-mo sort of approach to this stuff, or do you just think they're living on it in a different universe?
Sometimes I pity them, but other times I envy them.
I think it can be both frustrating. Like, sometimes it's frustrating, just cause, like, if you're trying to do something with them, it just takes longer.
Yeah.
But other times I think I don't think about it that much. I think that, I mean, like, we're going to be in that position eventually.
Yeah.
Like,
well, I always thought that the 13-year-olds are like the place where you watch them, because they're too young to have known earlier technologies. So whatever they're using now is what they've always known. They're totally fluent in it, as if it's like some part of their body.
Yeah.
They so it's like a fish swimming in the water. Like, they don't know about air, they don't know about ground. Just do that. And then you get to be 15 and you look over your shoulder and there's some 13-year-old doing something you've never seen before, and that's how it begins.
Yeah.
That was with me in Juuling. I came home. Do you know what a Juul is?
No, we don't.
No, we need to talk about this.
What is a Juul?
A Juul is like this...
It's a unit of energy, usually.
Yeah, but now it's basically an electronic cigarette.
Okay.
But it's supposed to be very chic, and it plugs into a USB port to charge, and it's like... It's very, like, popular among people who are not our year. People below.
All the kids
and
are doing
it. And it's because they didn't see 9/11.
Yeah, exactly. I have two brothers who are twins, and they're 2 years younger than me. And when I came back, after they had just come back from college for the first time, what happened was, I walk into this room where we have all our stuff, and they're with all their friends playing Xbox, playing Fortnite,
of course,
surrounded by themselves, like almost furiously, like plugging Juuls into USB ports, taking them out and then smoking them and then putting them back in. And every aspect of that was completely foreign to me.
Wow. So you, and did they know that it was foreign to you? They stared at you like, so you were like an old guy.
Yeah, and it was very
interesting. You realized you were archaic.
It was alienating because it was in my own house and to people that I've grown up with my entire life.
Mm. Well, this is like the rest of your future. This is what's going to happen to you constantly. At some point, someone will not even know what happened on 9/11. You know?
Yeah.
Like, I remember, because mine was Jack Kennedy being killed, mm-hmm. I remember my first cousin's oldest son, this was maybe 1971 or 72, saying, who is Bobby Kennedy?
Mm.
Like, that would be like saying, and what is the moon? You know? I just didn't know that anybody wouldn't know that. And that's how it, and then it just goes on that way.
Is there a moment from your time in Oberlin that feels like something that is so important that we would have no idea about something like that?
There are a few. The night that Martin Luther King was shot, I was walking. It got pretty scary. There was a kind of a riot, and there were people hunting other people, or so we were. And there was a bunch of kids coming, and I dived into a bush and sat in the bush for a long time until I thought the coast was clear. That was a funny, because I didn't actually open them. I hadn't been a race divided like that until that moment.
Yeah.
And I also remember, I remember the kind of shock I had, I guess because I grew up in a time when my father was very conservative, and so communists were like, you know, devils. And they used to have something at 7 o'clock after dinner here called Arch 7. So you could go to the Arch where the Boxer Rebellion was memorialized. And it was like the Union's, it was like the place in London where anybody can get on a soapbox and say whatever they want. And there was a kid who was a couple of classes ahead of me who said, I am a communist. It was like saying, I have leprosy, or I'm gay in those days. Like, nobody was. There was no gay people. There were no communists. And then all of a sudden there was a communist. And I remember being completely shocked that I was looking at a communist who was my age, who was recruiting to go to a civil rights meeting in Cleveland, in Huff, in a neighborhood in Cleveland. And so that seemed like a fairly mundane thing, but he said he was a communist. And that was the first time when I think I realized that the universe I had been born into had certain proper nouns that seemed like kingdoms, and the windows were breaking in those proper nouns. When you actually look at one, so college for me, you know, I think the first gay guy that I knew here didn't know he was gay until after we left here. Like, they were just invisible. Mm-hmm. And I remember being thinking, wow, like, so of all this time you've been like lusting after guys? He goes, yeah, all this time. My roommate would leave the room and I would furiously masturbate, and hoping he wouldn't come back too quickly. I said, well, why is that homosexual? That's just regular. He said, no. So I was masturbating about him. I said, oh, that's different. And I thought, oh, well, so that there are these things where you suddenly, and this will probably seem very antique to you because it's like so long ago in some social way, but it was, there were certain things that just, they're so startling because you're born into a logic and into a universe and into a set of tropes that you don't even know you're in until they break. And then all of a sudden you think, oh, and that's just growing up. I don't know that it has to do with Oberlin College.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But it helped, I think. It helped break the tropes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it did. I mean, there was a lot of guys screwing guys' drawings in what used to be called Carnegie Library, which is now the whatever that is, some large empty building with like dinners in. And I would go in there, and those were carefully wrought, full of desire drawings. And I kept wondering, like, who do I know that would be drawing these drawings? Like, I thought, you know, and I really wondered. Hmm. But so did the other gay guys. The other gay guys who were doing it didn't know about each other. So there was this, I mean, it was a closet within a closet within a closet, I guess. And that was just so, I mean, now I think about it, the world is so much easier, I mean, in a way. I mean, what I think has suffered a little bit is men-women relationships have suffered because of all of this, of the current politics of, the politics of pronouns and the politics of touch and the politics of all this and that. It's now getting a little more, at least I notice in my office, it's much more careful than it was even 5 years ago, but it's probably also officially kinder and gentler and more careful. But something has been lost in the ease of men-women relationships, at least among 27-year-olds. I can see it, you know, like there's a certain, and so, really what's interesting is that if you keep your eyes open, you watch blossoms blossom and you watch beautiful things wilt a little and then blossom again all the time. It's like a constant change. It's like if you find it interesting to keep your eyes open, as I think you will, I think, like, I think, well, then you get to see weather that's sometimes sad and sometimes happy. And sometimes you don't even see it until it's over. And then people tell you about the weather that they were in. It's interesting, that part, I find.
Yeah.
I think that's right. Like, I think that we're circling back to the same thing, which is like, what is the relationship that we have to Oberlin? And I think that's very much it. That, like, it challenges you in ways that sometimes are really uncomfortable, sometimes not great, sometimes very good, but it helps you see things that blossom and die and then blossom again.
Well, a good reflection on graduation eve, commencement eve. So thank you, Robert.
Welcome.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Roman. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a good run.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you so much.
Thanks.